You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
More than $1 trillion in development-related aid has been transferred from rich countries to Africa over the past 50 years. But has all that money improved the lives of Africans? In Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa, a new book by Dambisa Moyo, the former consultant for the World Bank, examines the downsides of foreign aid and offers new approaches African leaders need to implement to push their nations toward development. It's published by Farah Strauss and Giroux, and it brings Ms. Moyo to our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You propose that all aid to Africa be halted within 5 years. How do you think that that would help African countries?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, I'm not talking about humanitarian or emergency aid, and nor am I talking about NGO or charity-based aid. Those two types of aid are very
small. So refugees and droughts and things like that.
Yeah, that's emergency aid. That's that. From a moral imperative, we can completely justify that as a society. But we cannot justify these over trillion dollar package that has gone to Africa on two metrics: growth and reduction of poverty, which is really the reasons why the architects of aid actually came up with the aid model. It's failed consistently.
Why 5 years rather than 6 or 10?
I picked 5 years for two reasons. One, 5 years was the duration of the Marshall Plan, which many pro-aid, so the diehard aid advocates, use as evidence, incorrectly use as evidence as that aid works. But I think the second point is that I really wanted to come up with a short, sharp, finite period under which we could really get our heads around getting away from this open-ended commitment.
Did you make a similar argument when you were working for the World Bank or for Goldman Sachs?
Well, when I worked at the World Bank many years ago, and it was really more of a learning experience then. I mean, this was in the 1990s, and so my knowledge of how the world worked at that time, I think, was quite naive. But having sort of more recently been at Goldman Sachs for almost a decade and really recognized that other emerging countries from Israel to Turkey, South Africa, and so on, were coming to the capital markets, I got kind of an exposure to the fact that there is a better way, an alternative way that other countries have implemented, and that works.
Well, 5 years is a very brief time. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't turning off the tap result in humanitarian crises throughout the continent?
I don't believe that at all. I believe that Africa right now is suffering from a very serious a crisis that is likely to only get worse if we continue down this path. If you just look at the statistics, in the 1970s, 10% of the African population was living under the poverty line. It's now over 70% at the same time when aid flows over time have been increasing. There's no evidence whatsoever to say that Africans would suffer from, the average African would suffer from the cutting off of the government-to-government flows.
Part of your argument is that aid is easy money and that if governments had to rely upon private financial markets, they would become accountable to lenders. Would private lenders demand more accountability than organizations like the World Bank and the IMF?
Absolutely.
Don't the World Bank and the IMF have very strict rules and regulations in their loan guidelines?
In theory, perhaps. In reality, not at all. Unfortunately, we live in a sort of low-level equilibrium where the World Bank, IMF, multilateral institutions are actually incentivized to give loans, whatever the case, because if they don't give loans, they don't exist. But on the other side, African governments are also incentivized to get this cheap money, cheap in the sense financially to some extent, but it's actually more expensive in the broader context. But it's easier. Why not? It's much easier to go and pick up a phone and call the World Bank and say, can you give me $100 million, rather than going around and talking to numerous investors who will ask you tough questions.
Well, since this would all depend on the genius of the free market, aren't people questioning the genius of the free market as a result of this current economic crisis?
They absolutely are. But, just to draw on President Obama's inaugural speech, at its core, there is no doubt that the free market economy or capitalist system has been the best system at delivering wealth and freedom. And I only wish that we as a society would question the aid model, which has had 60 years with very poor results, as aggressively and vociferously as we're criticizing the capitalistic model, which has 300 years of actually very good results.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that in addition, yes, regulation is important. I'm not saying that unshackled or unfettered capitalism is a good thing. Obviously, we're seeing the implications of that now. But, at its core, it still is the best system, and we cannot get away from that.
In fact, Goldman Sachs has had problems in this recent economic crisis. You write that aid enables corruption, promotes laziness, creates dependency, incites civil wars, and hamstrings civil society. What African nations do you think have been most hurt by it?
Well, I think there are extreme versions of a societal collapse. If I had to pick one fundamental problem with the aid system, it would be that it disenfranchises Africans. So Africans cannot hold their governments accountable. To draw on American history, no taxation without representation. There's a sense of that. We have many countries that are failed states. In the past 6 months alone, Africa's had four coups. Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, Mauritania, and just last week, Madagascar. That pattern of political instability, but also the extreme cases of complete failed states, such as we see in Somalia, are merely a glimmer of what we will continue to see if we do not completely turn the situation around.
Well, what about the alternative? Are there any African nations that have taken little aid and been successful?
Absolutely. We've got at one extreme, South Africa and Botswana, both on record, relatively low poverty rates, strong growth in the past couple of decades. More recently, we've seen places like Ghana, who have basically started to come to the capital markets and really forge a path that's based more on public transparency and accountability and moving away from this aid-dependent model.
Well, to some degree, what happened in Uganda was that a major civil war, the Lord's Resistance Army, has pretty much died down, and they were able to take care of other business. But for a long time, they were tied up in something that just use up so much of its money and energy.
That's absolutely right. And in the book, I argue that there's a perennial risk in Africa of political instability, because the only source of having any wealth, of garnering wealth, is through capturing the state, because that's where the aid money is. There is no entrepreneurial culture to the degree that one would want, where people feel like they have options instead of just going into government.
What about your homeland, Zambia? Mm-hmm. Is it moving away from receiving a lot of aid?
Not as quickly as I would like to see it do. There have been some very significant policies that have been put in place. I mean, this is not what I'm proposing. It's not an easy thing. It's an easy conceptual theoretical point, but practically it does take time and a lot of effort and political will. But yes, there have been some positive signs.
Well, what should Westerners do if they're not giving aid? Would the agencies that are now trying to help do different things, or should they just get out?
Well, the thing that frustrates me quite to a great degree is everything that I'm saying here should be coming and should be championed by the multilateral institutions. Things like microfinance should not be synonymous necessarily with an individual like Mohamed Yunus. It should be the World Bank pushing to get microfinance unveiled and rolling out across these countries. So is there a role for the global community? Yes. Africa is not an African problem. It is a global problem. We should all care. However, we have to bear in mind that Africa doesn't need pity upon which the aid model is based. It needs more jobs. And the way that will happen is if we change the mindset and approach the African problem.
My guest is Dambisa Moyo. Her book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Well, Mohamed Yunus has been here, and we've talked a lot about the microfinance approach. But isn't it rather limited in its applications, as successful as it's been?
I disagree, actually. I mean, I just was on a program with Mohamed Yunus a couple of weeks ago, and he said even in this market, he has been able to raise $1 billion in Bangladesh. This is rural Bangladesh at a time when the markets around us are collapsing. And I think perhaps what's more interesting about what he's been able to do is that he has not taken aid money to roll out this program, but the default rates are so small. Like, people scarcely default on this, to the extent that he's just rolled out the similar program here in New York. So, I mean, I think what if there's one takeaway from this discussion is that we need to innovate. It's been 60 years, $1 trillion. It has not delivered. Let's try and innovate. And microfinance is one way of participating for the global society to participate in this.
You like an organization called Kiva. What's that?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. It's out of California, an American couple, as I understand it. It's basically internet-based, and you and I, so individuals living in America, living anywhere in the world, can go on the website, kiva.org, and you can basically lend as little as $25 to anybody around the world who needs it. And they have a little bio on their story. And I think the operative word is lending, because it creates very positive incentives. If people feel like they actually have to get their businesses off the ground.
Well, lending also means, as you suggest, African countries expanding trade networks and developing bond markets.
That's right.
But aren't 9 of the world's 10 most hostile business environments in Africa? How can African states expect to attract foreign investment if the continent continues to have such a reputation for instability?
And you make my point exactly, that we will continue to have this type of dire political environment as long as there's aid. You know, if the governments are not incentivized to actually create positive environments that will attract foreign investors, we'll never get the good environments that we need.
You devote a chapter to a fictitious nation called Dongo to illustrate the problems created by aid dependence. Why create a fictional nation when there are so many real ones?
Well, it's precisely because of that. My book probably would not have an ending if I had to go through each and every country. I mean, there are 53 in Africa with varying degrees of desperation. But I just felt like, you know, getting the reader, this book was really targeted to the broader public. It's not for policymakers necessarily, because this literature, this discussion's already in the literature, sort of academic literature. What I really wanted is to get the reader to get a handle of what's really going on the ground, and I felt that to actually have a fictitional country would be much more effective in doing that.
And what would you have Dongo do?
Well, to do exactly as I prescribe in the second half of the book, to go out and issue debt, to make strides towards becoming more of a part of the global economy rather than becoming a junior citizen, a junior part of the world.
If you went back to Zambia and spoke to the political leaders there, do you think they would take you seriously?
Yes, I think they will, and I think they have. I mean, I've already had a number of meetings with some African presidents at their request. They've invited me over, and they're very, very keen to actually wean themselves off of aid. The president of Rwanda, for example, has been very publicly against aid, as has the president of Senegal. So I'm not, in the past, people have been blowing in the wind, so to speak, but I believe that now is a very good time to kind of sell the story of innovation.
My guest is Dambisa Moyo, M-O-Y-O. Her book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dambisa Moyo, who was born and raised in Zambia but has advanced degrees from Oxford University and Harvard University. She worked at Goldman Sachs for 8 years in the debt capital markets, hedge fund coverage, and in global macroeconomics teams, and before that worked at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. Her book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. There are a number of controversial things in this book, some things that have gotten people stirred up. One of them is you suggest that African states shouldn't focus on creating democratic reforms but work towards creating a free market economy instead. But wouldn't one result from the other?
Yes, one does result from the other, and the prerequisite for a stable, long-term democratic system is a strong economy.
You mean like in China?
You need like a middle class. Well, there's a lot of literature coming out now that you're actually seeing some evidence of democratic process beginning to brew in China. So I'm very optimistic there also. What I am saying, though, is that in the context of Africa, there is no surprise that we continue to see quite shaky democratic processes going across the continent.
But you go as far as to suggest that poor countries need a decisive, I'm quoting, decisive, benevolent dictator to push through the reforms required to get the economy moving. You think a democracy is just too slow?
I think that a democracy doesn't necessarily work in a very poor environment where there are no vested interests, particularly in an environment where the government has basically abrogated all its responsibilities. Many African countries, the education, health care, infrastructure, and even security have completely been taken off their hands, and the donors are the ones who are dealing with that. So what's the purpose of a democracy in that sort of an environment? It's not obvious to me that there is.
Well, how do you get benevolent dictators? So far, Africa has had quite a few dictators, and very few have been benevolent. I remember years ago being in a cab with somebody from one of the African nations that was going to Ghana, in fact, I think it was. And there'd just been a coup, and he said that he was discouraged, but he'd like to go back, and he would provide the kind of leadership that the country needed. I said, that means you would not be stealing from the treasury. He said, oh, of course I would. why be the ruler if you can't get your piece of the action?
Right, but that's, you're precisely arguing the point that if you do have a dictator in place, you still have the only way in which they become benevolent is if they can be held accountable. And the only way that they'll be held accountable is if they're not relying on somebody else to give them aid. And I think we know that the problem, one of the fundamental problems with aid, is that it doesn't matter what kind of a despot you are, you can still get aid from abroad.
Well, then we cut aid off. Mm-hmm. Robert Mugabe, he still remains in power. Okay. And now, Robert Mugabe, when he began, he was seen as a progressive leader.
No, that's true. And it's actually not the case. According to my research, Mugabe got money upwards of $300 million from the US and UK only a few years ago. So it's not the case that he's not receiving money even at this point. And besides, as we know, the British and American governments both still maintain diplomatic ties with Zimbabwe.
Would you consider a country like Libya a positive example for the rest of the continent?
Well, I mean, Libya's obviously made significant strides to bring itself back into the global fold. I like many other places on the African continent, I think it's got a lot of work to do. However, one thing that is commendable is that the leadership in Libya is very focused on Africa's PR in a positive way. There's too much imagery about Africa is what I call the four horsemen of Africa's apocalypse, which is war, disease, poverty, and corruption. And the leadership in Libya right now, who is also the leadership of the African Union, is very focused on changing that.
Well, Gaddafi said to the African Union, make me the equivalent of the leader of all of Africa and everything will be resolved. And, of course, nobody's going to do that. Do you think that aid is uniquely problematic for Africa? Or would you give the same advice to developing nations in Asia and Latin America?
Well, I would give the same advice to any emerging economy. But as we all know, the Asian economies and many of the Latin American economies already figured it out that aid is actually part of the crippling part of their story as opposed to an elixir or catalyst for economic growth. So I'm focused on Africa because that is still the place where we haven't really figured it out just yet.
A listener wonders what you think of faith-based aid.
I think if I had to criticize faith-based aid, I should say, first of all, I consider faith-based aid more like NGOs and charities. And so in that sense, relatively small beer, not what I'm talking about in this book. If I had to criticize the faith-based type of aid, very much like the celebrity cultures, that they tend to focus on the negative parts of Africa and not highlight the positives. And frankly, most Africans don't want to raise their children in an environment where the world constantly is picking at them and saying that they're poor and they've got lots of these issues.
Some people have seen a negative side to the celebrities who have tried to help Africa, like Bono and Bob Geldof and George Clooney, as being a modern-day version of the white man's burden.
I have, I guess, three fundamental problems with the celebrity culture. First of all, I think they're wrong to push aid because I think they don't really – it's basically the arguments that I made in the book. I don't think aid is the solution here. And second of all, I think they exemplify precisely the problem with the aid culture, that African leadership has, by and large, been silenced, can't be bothered to be on the global stage and explain what their plan is for the future of Africa. And so basically this opened a vacuum and anybody could step in. And, of course, the celebrities have stepped in. I've quipped that Americans would be quite upset if the Obama administration took a back seat and somebody, a celebrity from somewhere else came in and started to speak. But the last thing I want to say about the celebrities is what I've said already, that they tend to focus on the negative stories in Africa. They don't stand up and say, actually, there's some interesting positive things happening. We should support that.
We often talk about the problems of Africa being the legacy of colonialism. But how much is what we're talking about the legacy of the Cold War, where the United States and the Soviet Union got involved in a kind of a power struggle in the way that they gave aid to African countries?
The points that you raise are definitely a part of Africa's history. However, as I outline in the book, I think for Africa, Africans, or the global community as a whole to focus, to point to tribalism or geography or colonialism as the rationale or as an excuse for why Africa is in the malaise that it's in, I think it's a waste of time and it's a red herring. Other countries on this earth have been colonized, India, for example, and nobody feels sorry for India. Nobody even even brings up the issue of colonialism, they've moved on. And it's important for Africa and Africans to move on. It's been 40, 50 years for many African countries. Yes, we've had a colonial past. We will always have a colonial past. It's part of the history. But it is not a rationale, you know, 50, 60 years on after independence to continue to explain the downfall of these economies.
You studied under Jeffrey Sachs, didn't you?
That's right, yes.
Do you think he would go along with any of the things you're saying?
I have been quite disappointed with Professor Sachs's commentary because I do think it's intellectually dishonest. I was in his class for a year, throughout which he talks about Bolivia, Eastern Europe, Russia, Poland, so on, and the mechanisms in which those countries could and should achieve economic growth. And many of the prescriptions he prescribed are like the ones in my book, which are very market-based. However, when it comes to Africa, he's got a completely different model of economic development, which has no basis in fact or logical evidence. There is no evidence that countries can develop or have developed based on aid. So why it's kind of befuddles, confuses my mind that he's pushing something that he knows doesn't work, and yet he knows what works. And so it does really make me wonder why it is that he's pushing this prescription.
You've dedicated your book not to Peter Sachs, but to Jeffrey Sachs, but to Peter Bauer.
That's right.
Now, you admit that your ideas are not new.
Not at all.
To a large degree borrowed from his?
Absolutely. I feel, I suppose, and if I may be vain, I'll say that I feel at this particular moment in time, perhaps I'm the one who's holding the torch on these ideas. Even more recently than myself, people like Bill Easterly have also commented and written books about this. But, you know, they tend to be ignored. And Peter Bauer in the 1950s and 60s talked about this and was ignored. And it's a great pity. I'm sure I'm not very sanguine that people will actually care about what I'm saying in the long term. But, where Africa is right now with over 60% of the population under the age of 24, if we don't do something dramatic, in another 100 years or another 40 years, to get to 100 years, somebody else will be sitting here saying the same thing.
Well, there are many Americans who resent all the foreign aid dollars that leave this country at times when there are so many problems here. You think they'll be heartened by what you're saying here?
Well, I think people want to help. It's a natural course of humanity. I think what those people might be looking for is a more realistic, sustainable way to help in a way that can get Africa off on its own two feet and not a situation where they're perpetuating a cycle of despair.
My guest is Dambisa Moyo. Her book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another area that has been controversial, in fact, was talked about this very morning on Morning Edition, was what you've said about China in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the Chinese have done, undisputedly, managed to do what the Western world has failed to do in 60 years, and they've done it in just over a decade. And it's to provide roads, to provide jobs, and to provide opportunities for many Africans on the ground. It's not to say that the Chinese in Africa are a perfect situation. There's a lot of scope for improvement. And my view is that the policing or holding the Chinese accountable within Africa is, the responsibility of African governments. But if African governments are not incentivized to police the Chinese, that situation is absurd.
But many people complain that Chinese money is propping up countries or dictatorships in countries like the Sudan.
I think I talk about this in the book. I think it's kind of farcical that some of the worst despots in Africa have been in power under the ostensible reign of the Western society, Mobutu Sese Seko, Idi Amin, so on and so forth. And now the Chinese have been in Africa 5 to 10 years, and we all want to disregard the positive things that they've done in terms of roads and development and focus on places where there's much more scope for development. Sudan still gets a significant amount of aid from Western countries and Western institutions. Why are we not discussing that?
Why do you think China has decided to take risks in Africa while the West has been more reticent?
I'm not certain that it's risks per se. I think it's just a different...
Well, we're talking about some unstable countries.
Oh, of course. But I think that they just have a better understanding of the risk in that sense. And so they understand that Africans want jobs. They want good infrastructure and health care and so on. And they recognize that there's an opportunity to build an alliance based on incentives as opposed to just, we're a senior donor and you're the junior recipient.
Although I have heard complaints from people in Africa that the Chinese come in and act like they are superior, and you're there to do their bidding. There isn't as much of a personal exchange as people in Africa are used to.
Well, I don't know who those Africans are which exchange that they're having, because I think if there's one criticism of the aid model is that they feel that there's a sense that Africans are completely disregarded in terms of the aid structure. And besides, the Pew survey, which came out in 2007, which is an American-based institution, went to about 15 African countries and surveyed Africans to ask them about how they felt about the Chinese in Africa. Was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? How did it rank versus America? And consistently, the response, over 85% in many of the questions, Africans overwhelmingly felt that the Chinese were doing a good thing, bringing opportunities, and it consistently ranked higher than the United States, for example.
You say approximately 500,000 people are in the business of aid. What do you mean by that?
I mean that there are at least 500,000 people, mainly Westerners, who are working for NGOs and international development agencies, where I believe that it's not necessarily obvious all the time that their incentives are structured so that they want Africa to wean itself off of aid.
So, but you said earlier some of the NGOs you would admire, Doctors Without Borders, that kind mm-hmm. of group, but not the ones who are bringing rice to the villages?
Well, by and large, there are rice producers in Africa. If you bring in free or cheap rice to Africa, you kill off that rice producer domestically. In the case of Doctors Without Borders, I think it's important that we transfer those skills. We need more African doctors on the ground. It's not a long-term strategy anywhere, not just in Africa, anywhere across the world, to have your healthcare system, your infrastructure, your security, and your education reliant on foreigners coming in and, you know, every now and then providing this. This is what African governments need to do, and that's what I'm focused on here.
Well, there's been a brain drain. There are plenty of very well-educated Africans who have chosen not to live in Africa.
And again, I think the brain drain is an artifact of the aid system. People do not, educated people who are looking for incentive-based opportunities so they can get better pay, they can have a better life for their children, do not want to live in an environment which is laden with creaking bureaucracy or corruption.
And that's why you don't live in Africa?
That's why I don't live in Africa for now.
International development is a popular subject in colleges and universities across the world. What would you tell American students enrolled in these programs if they hope to work for a development organization in Africa?
I would say that it's important to innovate. America is built on innovation. President Obama has come into the United States presidency on the wave of innovation. Here's an opportunity to innovate. We've had enough time, enough iterations of the aid model to test it. It hasn't worked. And so now is a good time to say, how can we innovate in this model? How can we actually apply things that do work that we know for sure?
President Barack Obama has said that he wants to increase aid to Africa. Mm-hmm. And the Financial Times is reporting today that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling on the G20 countries to support a $1 trillion stimulus package for developing countries threatened by the global financial crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to make a clear delineation between bailout support, which arguably countries like Eastern Europe are looking for now with their balance of payment crises and foreign exchange crises, and the other type of aid, which is long-term, open-ended aid support, which I think does not work. So in the case of the G20, a lot of the calls for intervention are really focused on bailout support, given that these countries are going through some rough times. But it's very clear that Eastern Europe is not going back to communism. It's still going to be on a path of free market. It's just that in these bumps, in the bumps that we're experiencing right now, there might be a way to assist them.
And since it's only over 2 years, it would still fit within your five-year...
Absolutely. It's not a long-term, open-ended commitment which Africa continues to rely on.
Thank you so much for being with us
today.
Thank
you so much. I really appreciate being here.
Dambisa Moyo's book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
Thank you.